Do you know your taxa?
You have species, which is quite specific, genus, which is a bit more of a loose conglomeration, and then you have families, which are even broader and have some characters in common.
The difference between a species, a genus, and a family can sometimes get confusing, especially when plant names seem like they're changing more than ever before.
Is it a policy that the new names have to be longer than the previous ones?
Did somebody decide that? I do admit that it seems that something nice and easy to say becomes something absolutely tongue-twistingly terrible to say.
Take the recent cases of things like Hebes and Veronicas, for example, or even common rosemary, being moved into the genus Salvia, swapping its scientific name from Rosmarinus officinalis to Salvia rosmarinus. Well, if you've ever felt perplexed about why these changes are happening, or have wondered what gardeners have to gain, Jenny Lavell will be speaking to esteemed RHS botanist James Armitage to untangle the words later in the show. Today we'll also be indulging in the delights of early spring, in particular, Chenomeles. Chenomeles being a genus of four species of deciduous spiny shrubs in the family Rosaceae. You may know them as flowering quince or Japanese quince, and they provide stunning displays of early blooms through to May.
We could do half an hour just how you pronounce it. There's a Chenomeles trial going on, and I kid you not, we went round and every single one of us pronounced it differently. And then Abraham from Calm Thought, he said, no, he said, you're doing that all wrong. You know how you pronounce that? Japanese flowering quince.
Gareth Richards will be talking to David Ford, the holder of the National Plant Collection of Chenomeles in Surrey, about his love affair for the plant and why they're due a mainstream revival. All of this to come in today's episode of Gardening with the RHS, with me, Guy Barter. As we all know, March is prime time to get practical and planting in the garden. And when you've got a big or small plot, containers offer the opportunity to create mini ecosystems of excitement, colour and diversity. We caught up with garden designer and writer Anne Trenneman for some inspiration.
My name is Anne Trenneman. I am a gardener and a writer, and I have written a new book called Greener Gardening Containers. A lot of people seem to think that you have to give something up to be an ecological gardener. You know, the lawn debate is the perfect example. Oh my God, I have to give up my lawn if I want to like wildlife. And it really is not like that. You can make containers into an ecosystem. And you can do it and it attracts wildlife. It's sustainable, it's totally doable. There are quite a few ways to make containers into like a habitat. One is to have a series of small containers, and that might be necessary for some people who are maybe on a balcony with very limited space, or maybe they only have a windowsill. But then the other option is to do a larger container with some compatible plants that work together. So I quite enjoyed putting together some of these combinations for the book. One was a bee cafe. One was kind of a garden meadow. And then I also really went other places. I did a water pot, so you'd have like a little pond in a pot, and a patio orchard, which is a really fun idea. You know, if you love succulents, you can have a dry container garden. If you love weeds, you can have a weed container garden. I mean, you can just do anything you want. You can have trees in containers if you want to. I think this time of year, when it's all been slightly bleak for a few months, it's really great to think about having a spring container or a group of spring containers. I went to the DIY store the other day and watched people, but it was very touching to watch the people with the care that they were showing, you know, this little daffodil or that daffodil, these crocuses. And it really touched me because it made me realize yet again that people want to have something that makes them smile every time they look at it. So I think my first sort of spring container idea is do that. Use what you want. You can basically walk by a supermarket or lots of other places have these things like primroses. They have wallflowers this time of year. A lot of them will have the small bulbs that you can transplant, put them together, and you can have a really cheerful and happy container that is easy to do, not complicated. I would add garlic mustard, which I know some people think is a weed, but I do not think is a weed. And I also love that because it attracts the orange tip caterpillar, butterfly, etc. And so that helps them, but I also, it's quite tall, so I will always be adding something like that in. And I have a million forget-me-nots in my yard, and so I like to put those in containers as ground cover because they look great for quite a few weeks, and it really adds a bit of zing to everything. The other idea, which is, this is a much more sophisticated look, would be what I would call, like, I think they're now calling it the Venetian colors or something, but they're very rich, they're very red, and it's basically based around the hellebores. There's all these beautiful Lenten roses that have, range from white, pinkish, they've got some dark reds. I would say that, you know, you need to buy the single petals, no double petals, because bees find them confusing. So you have that, but you can also add into that a euphorbia that actually has really dark burgundy leaves. There's also heucheras that have the dark burgundy leaves that you can put in. Or you could have something like violets, something like that around the bottom. So that would be a little bit similar. You've got some of those colors, but that's quite a rich one. And I think it would look great if it's quite large. My third idea, which I think is very Eastery, is that you'd have a fairly large container and that you'd be planting a tree in it, which would be a hazel. But I would buy a contorted hazel. They're very beautiful anyway, and they're very interesting. And they look great in containers, and you can use them for so many things. You can grow things up them. They look so beautiful on their own. They've got the catkins this time of year. You can buy a red variety, which is also extremely beautiful, especially in the summer when the sunlight is coming through the leaves. Because of the contorted branches, you'll be able to hang some wooden eggs if you wanted to. Maybe some chocolate, and that's quite nice. And then you can underplant that with a really nice sort of something for pollinators, like forget-me-nots or daisies, the little daisies, the wildflowers. And one of the things is you can keep adding new ground covers as summer continues, so you can then move on to wild strawberries or something like that. In other words, you don't have bare earth. I think those look really happy, and obviously children love them. To build a sustainable or eco-friendly container garden, it requires what I suppose they would call now what would be mindfulness, but I would just call consideration. So thinking, you know, do I need to have a plastic pot, a new plastic pot? No, I don't. How can I make sure that I always have peat-free? It makes sense to use rainwater. Why don't I organize a way that I can, you know, contain that and gather it during the year, because there's no lack of it in general. Use compost or make your own compost, have a compost pile. At least think it through and think if it's possible. Because all of these really add up to creating a garden that, quote unquote, does no harm, does only good. And it's relatively easy to do, I'm happy to say.
Thanks to Anne Trenneman. Her book, RHS Greener Gardening, Containers, is out soon. It's easy for containers to be not as sustainable as they could be. What I do is I recycle the compost year on year. So last year's compost will get 20% by volume of small bark chips and a cupful of fertiliser per bucketful. And then I'll top that up with 5 to 7 centimetres, that's 2 to 3 inches, of fresh potting compost and plant into that. And then I'll water it with wastewater from the house, from the kitchen or from the bathroom, and possibly some rainwater, depending on how it rains, to keep my containers as sustainable as possible. It's easy to get carried away with large quantities of fresh compost, which is expensive, and using tap water, which is questionable if it turns to drought. But it's ever so easy to keep your containers sustainable. Next up, we're continuing our series called Just Ask with Jenny Lavell. Now, as gardeners, we've all had our own run-ins with things like pronunciations of Latin names, and often get tangled between words like genus, species and family when describing our green friends. Does it matter? Well, yes and no. Recently, there have been a number of name changes to plants we all know and love, and it's all got to do with how plants are related and working out the best ways of classifying them. Keen to know why, Jenny Lavell asked the questions to RHS botanist and editor of the Plant Review, James Armitage.
Hi, it's Jenny, and I'm back with James Armitage to talk about another puzzle of the horticultural world. Well, puzzle for me anyway. And that is, why do plant names have to change? Hi, James. How are you?
Well, I'm all right. Hello, Jenny.
So are you all right to take on this bit of a hot topic?
Why do plant names change? Well, essentially, it's got to do with having new information, more information, and that affecting your understanding of how plants are related and the best way of classifying them, and names changing because you're trying to incorporate this new understanding that we have.
Right. So it's not just a decision to change the name. It's based on finding out more about the plant.
Yeah. It's not just to be annoying, though that can be...
It's a side effect, let's face it.
That can be a side effect of changing names. But what might also be a side effect is, in the longer term, a more stable set of names and perhaps a more informative set of names.
Okay, so what would trigger a name change?
Well, a lot of name changes these days are due to the modern technology of DNA analysis. So that gives us a whole new set of tools to start exploring how plants are related to one another. For hundreds of years, people have just been going, oh, well, I look at that plant and I look at that plant and I think they're related. So the names that Linnaeus came up with in 1753, he called a lawn daisy Bellis perennis, and we still call it Bellis perennis. So it's amazing, actually, how little plant names do change. But it would be silly for us to think that with all this new information that we've got, that they aren't going to change, that this isn't going to shed new light on our understanding and consequently lead to name changes.
Right. So that's the theory. But in practice, can we just go through some of the plant name changes that have happened and just explain why? Like the Aster genus, what happened that changed recently?
So with something like Aster and Symphoritrichum, for quite a long time that Aster was a bit of a dumping ground when it came to plant names. So if it was a daisy and didn't know quite where it should go, well, we'll just call it an Aster. But whenever you can look at the DNA of these things, you see how the different groups of species come out and where they're related and what's truly related to this, what's not. And actually, it turns out that Aster should be quite a lot smaller, and something called Symphoritrichum, which is not nearly as easy or pleasing to say, should be a lot bigger. And so a lot of the things that we had been calling Aster in our gardens quite happily for a long time become Symphoritrichum. But in the long term, we might find that that's more helpful, because with the names comes all sorts of knowledge. You know, maybe Symphoritrichums are more likely to catch the same pests. Maybe they're more likely to cross together. A whole suite of information
so
goes...
There's practical benefits to it.
There's practical benefits to the name change.
It's not just like a cataloguing thing.
Well, it is partly a cataloguing thing. The idea is to get the most predictive taxonomy or arrangement of names as we possibly can.
Right. Is it a policy that the new names or the have to be longer than the previous ones? Did somebody decide that?
I do admit that it seems always to be the case that something nice and easy to say becomes something absolutely tongue-twistingly terrible to say. So although Asters and Symphoritrichums remain the same family, the Asteraceae, which is the daisy family, they are more distantly related than perhaps we previously thought. And so they're in different genera, which is the plural for genus.
Right. And so, and the family is kind of like higher.
The family is even more inclusive again. Right. So you have species, which is quite specific, genus, which is a bit more of a sort of loose conglomeration of species. And then you have families, which are broader and have some characters in common, but not as many as in genera, and not as many again as in species.
So with the Asters, you get a big genus being split up. Does that ever happen the other way around, where plants are being incorporated together?
Good word, incorporated. Yeah, so that's called syncing, often in the world of taxonomy. And a good example would be Rosmarinus and Salvias. So rosemary's previously out on their own, and they've been incorporated, sunk into Salvia.
Oh, that's nice.
So it was known for a long time that rosemaries were closely related to salvias, but when the DNA was looked at, it became clear that there was no real reason to keep them as a separate thing. And actually, they remain in the same family, the Lamiaceae, which is the mint family. But yeah, it's acknowledged that Rosemaryinus is actually very closely related to salvia. It's just a bit of an anomalous one with little narrow leaves, but otherwise it's very much a salvia.
Thank you. So when you're keeping something in the inside in a genus, you've got like that belongs to that. Is there a set rule, amount of things that those plants have to have in common? Who decides that? Is it strict?
There really isn't, because there can't be any hard and fast rules because plants aren't hard and fast things. So really you've got to get to know a group of plants and get to know what is an important character with that group of plants and what's a kind of irrelevant character that might change quite quickly or might not really be very informative about relationships.
So it's no longer the case of just looking at a rosemary flower and going, that looks like a salvia flower. You've got the DNA to show how it's...
You've got it exactly. So before, you might have one taxonomist or botanist saying, well, I think fleshy fruits versus dry fruits are very important in this group. And another one saying, well, I don't think that matters at all. And so they disagree and the thing flip-flops back and forth. But when you add DNA into the equation, well, then you've got loads and loads and loads of characters. You can look at huge, long sequences of DNA and say... Well,
I mean, that sounds like an awesome night.
Well, it's, it certainly passes the time for some people. But you can just make a much more thorough examination of the true similarity between these different...
This is a massive process then.
A huge process, yeah.
I guess I don't know why I have it in my head that there's like an annual meeting of botanists who get together to decide what plants they're going to change the name of. It doesn't sound like that's what happens.
No, I think this is one of the great misunderstandings about how taxonomy
works. Thank you. I do like it. It's my favourite misunderstanding.
There isn't any sort of universal committee telling us what names we must all use. There's no legal imperative to use any particular name. It's just a matter of personal choice. But of course, having said that, it doesn't help very much if we all use different names, just as it doesn't help if we all use different names for kitchen utensils or car models or anything else. If we're all using pretty much the same set of names, it makes communication
Yeah. So what you're saying is there's no point getting like upset or offended by a plant that you've always called one thing. Just if you want to, you can keep calling it that.
You can keep calling it that, yeah. And or maybe even use it as a common name. You know, I think Hebe and Veronica is a good example of that. Hebe was a really convenient split for gardeners, I think, to have all the shrubby Veronicas known as Hebe, because then, you know, it's a distinctly different thing in the garden. It has a different garden usage. But when you look at the DNA again, you find that there's no real reason for Hebes to be kept separate from Veronicas. And so they've all been sunk back into Veronica now. So we've at the RHS, we've had a trial of shrubby Veronicas, which previously we would have called Hebes. But perhaps we can hold on to it just as a common name. So it's kind of useful.
It's a cute name.
It's a good name, and it's a useful name, so why not just use that as a common name?
If things are changing, is there a definitive source that I can find?
There isn't a definitive source, because like you say, there's no plant police, but there are lists of standardised names, and the RHS definitely does its bit when it comes to that for plants in gardens. So RHS Plant Finder, which is also available online as Find a Plant, is an invaluable source to tell you what the names for garden plants are, but there's other online sources. Yeah. Plants of the World Online is a source that Kew provide for plants in the wild. So there's a few of them about now.
Fantastic. They have all the names, so I don't have to. Brilliant.
So, yeah, you can look them up. And the RHS does have its own committee, the Taxonomy and Nomenclature Advisory Group, which puzzles long and hard about some of these issues of what to call garden plants particularly. So, yeah, safe pair of hands.
So for one last thing, can I just, I've made a little note of some of the words that have come up that I have no idea what they mean. So would it be okay to just do like a big word round and you can explain what these words are to me?
Yes, it would.
Good. Okay. Ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Taxonomy.
Taxonomy is just a scheme of classification. So if a taxonomist is somebody who comes up with schemes of classification, so how we compartmentalise things.
Okay, so like the library system or something.
Yeah, and anything, your filing system.
And related, taxa and taxon.
Well, taxon is just a unit within that, so maybe a species, but could also be a genus, could be a cultivar, it's just any level within that classification,
okay.
And would be just the plural of that.
Okay, so that's just, it's just like a unit.
It's actually, I really wish it's a word that would catch on, because in
let's start a movement.
Let's get this one off the ground, because I often find in writing things that you're struggling for a word meaning a bunch of different kinds of plant. So you might have species and cultivars and subspecies and whatever in there. And it would be really handy just to be able to say taxa, but nobody really knows what it means until now, obviously.
Let's make taxa happen.
Let's make taxa happen, yeah.
And finally, phylogeny.
So phylogeny is just how organisms are related to each other. And you'll hear monophyly used a lot today. So that's the idea that plants within different groupings in your taxonomy should all be related more closely to each other than they are to any other organism. So that's the arrangement that taxonomists aim at these days, to try and get all the things under the same name more closely related to each other than they are to things under a different name.
Thanks there to Jenny Lavell and James Armitage. And as James mentioned, if you're struggling with plant names, the RHS Plant Finder is a really good resource. We'll put a link in the show notes. Before we go on, I want to quickly mention two other words which weren't covered by their chat: varieties and cultivars. A variety is defined as a naturally occurring variation of a plant within a species. The term cultivar is an abbreviation of cultivated variety. As its name suggests, a cultivar is a variety cultivated by humans, and usually one not found anywhere in natural habitat. I say this because our next guest is David Ford, an avid collector of Chenomeles cultivars.
So David, by way of introduction, can you tell me where your love affair with Chenomeles began? I hear it runs in the family.
It does, Gareth. You have to go back to my childhood. So when I was young, in the family home outside in the front garden, underneath the hall window, was a huge great Chenomeles. Large flowered apricot, probably a japonica. And we had it, and my uncle and aunt had a cutting of it, and my grandparents had cuttings of it, and grandma would collect the fruit every autumn, and that would be used to make jelly. And wow, she would use a spoonful of that to set her strawberry jam the next summer.
Good Lord.
Because they're very, very high in pectin.
Yes, of course, which will help the jelly set.
So at a time when you couldn't buy pectin in the supermarkets, you know, that fruit was what she was using to set her strawberry jam. So, I mean, so my love affair goes right back to that. Extraordinarily enough, of course, there's been such a decline in the availability of Chenomeles that actually the one that I remember from my childhood would not be available should you want to buy it in this country any longer.
I guess that kind of speaks to the value of having national plant collections then, doesn't it? Like the one that you hold.
It does. I mean, plant heritage, what we're all about is trying to conserve our garden plants. And I think when I started researching Chenomeles, I hadn't found a genus which really highlighted the need for someone to actually act as guardianship to the plants quite like that. So there's a really lovely piece of work that a lady called Claude Weber did, and she spent about 4 or 5 years in America and Europe and the UK and then back to America researching them, and came up with a list that she published in 1964, naming 750 cultivar names.
Wow.
Which she thought referred to about 300 or 400 plants. So it comes out, if you work it out precisely, it's about 350.
So why do you think the number, because we don't have that many available today, why do you think the number of them has declined?
They're not plants that are going to make a nursery a fast buck. They don't bloom particularly well when they're young. So when you're selling them in a garden centre and people want something that looks really special, that's going to draw their eye in a garden centre, a lot of the Chenomeles cultivars aren't going to do that for them, because they don't really start blooming really well until they get to a little bit older. The other thing, that they're a little bit straggly, some of them. They're thorny, but not thorny enough like a pyracanthus. They're not going to improve the security of your property. They're just thorny enough that when you put your hand into them, you cut yourself.
You know about it. Yeah,
you know
yeah.
about it. So I think that's it. And they do need a little bit of pruning to make them look nice. And I think that there's some of the reasons. I mean, but I think the main one has been the loss of our really small nurseries that will be prepared yes. to put the time in. And in fact, when I'm collecting plants and looking for plants now, nurseries' old stock fields have become quite a useful place to find ones that have disappeared.
But tell us a bit about why they're worth growing. Can you sort of describe them for someone who's never seen a Chenomalese before? What do they look like? When do they flower? And what kind of benefits do they have, say, for wildlife or for the gardener?
So they're in the Rosaceae family. So they're related to the rose. They're related to apples and pears and all these Rosaceae plants. They have a huge range of forms. So we've got everything from a low-growing prostrate Chenomalese, which may not get more than 40 or 50 centimetres high, so really, really small. And they go everything up to small trees. So where we've got the species Cathiensis, that's going to grow 4 metres plus. Think the size of a Crataegus, something like that, so a hawthorn. Their flowers are what's so attractive for me. They bloom at a time when there's very little else blooming in the garden. So in the National Collection, I'll have the first Chenomalese coming into bloom, normally sometime around December, and the last ones finish in bloom, normally at the end of April or the beginning of May. So their benefit for the garden is huge. So as we have climate change, and we know the climate in this country has changed significantly from when I was born in the 60s, and we had very, very cold winters, you did not see a bumblebee in January. You didn't see a bumblebee in February. They were completely hibernating. And of course, now they're not. So they're up and about in January and February looking for nectar and pollen, and there is the Chenomalese to supply it. I mean, you know, with these lovely little blooms. So something like Cross Superba, Crimson and Gold, it will be blooming in December normally for you, and it will have sporadic blooms. It will do one flush, and then it will do sporadic blooms, and then if you feed it, it will do another flush, and even a third flush if you're lucky, and that will bloom all the way into April or May. So it's providing that pollen and nectar all the way through the year, as well as looking smashing.
Yes, yeah, I was going to say, because they're quite unusual for winter flowering things, because a lot of winter flowering things, you get sort of whites and sort of delicate pinks and whatnot. But these have really got some cracking deep reds and things like that, haven't they? With some real oomphy winter colour.
They are really full on. I mean, really extraordinary when you think that the ones that you'll see generally in the garden now, that has come just from two species. It's come from Chenomalis japonica that you get comes from Japan, and it's come from Chenomalis speciosa, which comes from sort of China and northern Bhutan, and the cross between the two. And we've got everything from the purest white all the way through whites and bicolours, through pinks, into yellows, into oranges, into deep oranges, into the deepest reds. So Flock on Rose, which is one of my favourites. The Japanese, I think it loosely translates as blurring, they call it, when the plants change, when the flowers change colour. So Flock on Rose, it will come out, the flowers on a single plant may be white. Most of them are tinged with pink. Some of them are quite deep pink. And then as the flowers age, they all get pinker.
And what kind of conditions do they like to grow? How do you get the best out of your Chenomalies in the garden?
They will grow anywhere. So if you want a lot of bloom, I would say give them as much sun as possible. So these are plants, they're mountainous, really. They've come from the scree slopes on mountains. So they'll go down to minus 30, no problem. And they'll cope with any conditions other than being completely waterlogged. Right. But they do like to have a lot of sun. In terms of soil condition, again, they'll grow on pretty well anything, but they do prefer it if it's a bit acidic. So I would suggest if anyone is really on chalk, as I am, then the best way of growing them is really in containers. And they make smashing container plants.
A bit of ericaceous compost.
Yeah, ericaceous, or even, you know, I mean, they will tolerate, as long as you're not too alkaline, they'll tolerate a normal cotton compost. Put about a fifth grit in to really let them get really good drainage. When you see them growing, particularly in positions where they're sort of next to walls and they're espaliered against fences and walls, they'll cope with those dry conditions, but they have got a root system that will go quite a long way down to find water.
They kind of know how to seek out what they need.
Absolutely.
But you just mentioned espalier. That's quite an interesting thing as well, because I've always sort of thought of them as these slightly messy, slightly straggly shrubs, but I can imagine if you espalier that, if you train it against a wall, you could make it look fantastic. Fantastic.
They can look fantastic. There's a beautifully espaliered one down at Sissinghurst Castle. They've got Knaphill Scarlet espaliered against the wall. It's old. It's one of Vita Sackville's West's original plants that they've been pruning. So it's an old plant. It just shows how old these go. And they've pruned it to the point they get proper blooming spurs on them, and it just looks stunning. If you want to go for one that's going to be a spalier world, you need to go for the speciosas. So okay. The Schneumli speciosas are the ones that are normally the largest growing.
Lovely. And can you recommend us any particular cultivars from the different groups?
Well, we're talking about espaliering and those ones that are going to grow up. That there's a couple that really spring to mind. Malusii. So Speciosa Malusii, bred in Germany in the 19th century. A beautiful, one of these bicoloured, it has apple blossom type blooms. And that's a stunning one to grow up a rule. If you wanted a different sort of colour, Nivalis would probably do that as well in white. If you could find Eximia, there are just a couple of suppliers of Eximia in this country and they do it in pink. Or Tom Rainey's collection, known as the Storm series. So any of the Storms, and these are all doubles.
Lovely. And what about something a bit smaller?
If you wanted to grow for length of blooming period, I would suggest something like Pink Lady, so Cross Superba, mm-hmm. Pink Lady, or maybe a Crimson and Gold as well. So that's a pink and a red. So they're really early. They won't get much taller than about 80 or 90 centimetres. Sargentii is a really good one for fruit. So I think we need to talk about the fruit
Tell me about the fruit, because that's quite an intriguing aspect of Schneumlis that people sometimes forget.
It is that they are fruiting. In fact, a lot of the research that's been done on the continent, both in Sweden and in Latvia, is actually as growing them to cultivate them for their fruit. They were at some point stuck and that people thought they were cydonias. They were classified botanically as cydonias. And that
as the true quince.
As the true quince, yeah. Absolutely. So if we look at sort of some of the species, the Cathayensis is the big tall one. And that does have fruit the size of small oranges, in fact.
Oh, my God.
Really, really large. But bear in mind, they are in the Rosaceae family. And just like apples and pears, they are not amazingly self-fertile. So if you want to grow for fruit, then always get at least two varieties,
right,
so two cultivars that are going to be in bloom at the same time to cross-pollinate, and that will definitely increase your chances of getting fruit.
And then how do you use the jelly? Is it something you can put on your toast in the morning?
I've made marmalade out of it. I've made the sort of jelly out of it. I'm vegetarian, so I quite often use it as a sauce to go over nut roasts. I was speaking to the curator at Campthout Arboretum in Belgium, and so they have quite a lot of very rare Schneumlis there, and he said with a little fruit, he said the best thing to do with those, if you want a really relaxing bath, throw the little ones into the bath and all the aroma comes out in the hot water.
I didn't
water.
Expect you to say that. I thought you were going to say soak them in vodka.
That could be another. I'm sure they would take that as well. The only thing you will see on the internet, quite incorrectly, people saying that the fruits are poisonous, which always annoys me. They are poisonous in exactly the same way that apple pips are poisonous. The pips and the core need to be removed, just as you would with apples before you cook them.
Yes, perfect. And just quickly, can you tell us about the National Collection? Because you are a National Collection holder.
I am.
I gather that the collection is moving. What's the latest?
The National Collection's here in Old Coulson. So this is one of the sort of plant heritage. We've got over 700 National Collections of plants around the country, of which the RHS really helps us, Wisley. The most National Collections in one garden at RHS Wisley.
Amazing.
But my one here, it started out, I never expected it to get quite so large. So one of the reasons we're moving is the size of it. I am up 85, pushing 90 named cultivars with another 10 or 15, which are botanically distinct from anything in the collection but are unnamed. So they're all in my garden here in containers ready to go.
Can people visit your National Collection?
They can visit the National Collection. Anyone's welcome, and people do come and view the National Collections. I'm there to help people around the world how to grow them. I'm there to help individuals that might have questions. I'm quite often called upon to answer just amateur gardeners' questions about plants that they have. But I'm also there to try and preserve some of the lost crosses, some of the lost cultivars, and try and reintroduce them.
So you're really helping to conserve that genetic diversity and that legacy of all these amazing cultivars.
Absolutely. And Plant Heritage has our wonderful best kept secret, which is our plant exchange. So all of us who are growing rare plants will pass out for free to other members of Plant Heritage our rare plants in order to record them as they move around the country. We encourage people then to register that they have the plant and where it is so that it's there for future generations. I am quite convinced that in years to come, people will look at the work of plant heritage and go, that is the way to go to conserve garden plants. Everyone needs to get involved. Everyone can look after a rare plant, be it on their windowsill, in their house, in a container, in their gardens. If we all look after one, we will save these plants one at a time.
Fantastic. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Kat. Thank you so much.
Thanks there to David Ford. You can find more about National Plant Collections via the link in our show notes. And David's plant knowledge is really fantastic. You'll see him as a regular judge at Chelsea Flower Show for the Plant of the Year competition. That's almost it for this episode. But before we go, I wanted to share a few things I've been up to in the garden this week. After some very wet weather, at long last it's drying out in the garden, and I'm getting the soil ready to sow and plant, putting down mulch, incorporating fertiliser where it's needed, and sowing seeds and putting out things like onion sets, and soon I'll start planting potatoes and bulbs and tubers, including begonias and dahlias, and just waiting for the soil to warm up a bit. However, there's plenty of time indoors to get planting and sowing, so my windowsills are covered in propagators and pots, and the greenhouse is rapidly filling up with plants. All these young plants will need protecting from slugs and snails, so I keep them indoors until they grow nice and big, and then they can take a bit of grazing from the slugs and snails. It's almost Easter, which is traditional plant buying time, but Easter's relatively early this year, so it's a good time to buy perennials, and garden centres will have lots of good offerings, including early ones like dicentras and bergenias in flower. But for tender plants, it's better to wait until May. So for your things like petunias and fuchsias, make a list of what you want and come back to the garden centre in May when the risk of frost has passed. So there's plenty to get on with, and spring has sprung, and it's a really enjoyable time, and what's more, there's time in the evening as well to do a few things in the garden, which is just as well because there's lots and lots to do and catch up with. And finally, we want to hear from you. If you're having issues on your allotment, or you have general horticultural questions you'd like addressed on the show, send us your queries at podcasts@rhs.org.uk. That's all for now. So from me, Guy Barter, goodbye and thanks for listening.